So I'm happy to have the caffeination slot in this morning because I figured that the whole audience will feel much better by the end of the talk than at the beginning if anyone's a coffee drinker, regardless of what I say, which is always a nice insurance policy. So I'm going to talk hopefully briefly about MHD and microphysics. The talk's a little technical. I was asked to kind of present something on methods and not hot new results, and I think I will vastly succeed at that task. So basically, I'm going to talk a little bit about the interaction of MHD and microphysics, or in some sense, the frequent lack thereof. I'll talk about the elements of a GRMHD code or review the elements of a standard GRMHD code with the Einstein toolkit as kind of a model because it's both public and the one that I've been spending most of my time on. I'll talk mostly about conservative to primitive conversion. It's a technical issue. It's the one place where a microphysical equation of state tends to interact most with magnetic fields in a non-trivial way in your average GRMHD code. I'll try to end by at least defining what makes for a well-defined equation of state, not from a proper microphysical perspective, but from the perspective of someone who's got more of a history on the hydrocoding side. You know, what do I need in order to make sure that the techniques I want to throw at a code are likely to work? So it's been noted here in several talks already that there's a lot of work going on both magnetohydrodynamic evolutions, microphysical evolutions, and in some cases both already. Both are highly active phases of development because in some sense general relativistic hydrodynamics with polytropes, say, is basically now kind of a commodity off-the-shelf product. By there are public codes that you can basically find and relatively quickly use. So certainly MHD and microphysics are the new bells and whistles that people are really trying. And they have very important physical effects that are changing our picture of things like binary mergers. I should say that several of the topics that might fall in this talk have already been covered extremely well by other people. So the best thing I can do is merely refer you to them. In low-density regions where magnetic fields dominate over fluid pressures, it changes how you want to perform a hydrodynamic evolution. But Carlos Palenzuela already gave a talk kind of describing how you handle a magnetosphere in a simulation. So I'll basically suggest his talk is a fantastic place to look if you want kind of the details of how to go about doing that. Neutron star crusts are a place where you expect potentially interesting interactions between magnetic fields on one side and the nuclear equation of state and just microphysical effects in general. I'm hoping basically that gets covered in today's talks on elasticity by Ian Hawk and Carsten Gundlach because I'm not going to say anything about it. There's a number of places where MHD and microphysics converge. I'm only going to talk about a small piece. I'm going to basically focus on the equation of state aspects and how those can be fitted into an MHD code that was set up for polytropes, basically. So going back to one of the slides that Matt Dewey showed, your average GRMHD code basically has roughly the same set of steps, no matter how you code it. There's the field evolution from general relativity. That's smooth. It's well-behaved. Between BSSN and generalized harmonic, it's fairly well understood these days. There's the matter evolution, where things aren't so smooth. So the typical codes, especially the conservative formulation ones, you've got a conservative to primitive variable step. You've got reconstruction at cell faces. You've got the solving of the Riemann problem. And then there's, of course, the possible inclusion of other microphysical effects, neutrinos, you name it. There's analysis steps in a code. There's grid architecture type things involving AMR and who knows what. If you ask yourself, though, the very limited question, where does the equation of state enter into the calculation? And how do we need to account for the fact that polytropes, you know, just aren't real? There's basically only two steps, and there's only one that's particularly involved. Certainly, the fluid sound speed is going to enter into the solving of the Riemann problem. But in a more limited way, conservative to primitive evolution is really where you have to work harder at it, and you have to be more careful, certainly. So the model I have in mind is, again, the Einstein toolkit. The Einstein toolkit is a public code base. So in some sense, everyone here has access to it, which is good. It's a community resource. So I'm going to kind of describe everything with the routines there in mind, though the routines there you're going to find are similar to what you'll find in any kind of code. The hydrodynamics module, GR Hydro, is basically based off of the whiskey code, but has since been developed during the past few releases. Recently, there's been the incorporation of a more general equation of state treatment for the code that Christian Ott has led development on, that in theory can handle any equation of state so long as you can specify how to set the pressure, derivatives of the pressure, and the other required hydrodynamic functions. MHD functionality is currently being added with a divergence cleaning treatment to maintain the no monopole constraint. And myself and many other people are leading the development of that project as we speak. If anyone has any questions about that, I'm certainly happy to answer them later. So the equation of state comes in primarily through the conservative to primitive variable conversion. So just a quick review of how that works. Conservative variables are an inherent part of any relativistic code, basically. They're unavoidable. It comes up in SPH or grid-based codes. It's a function of the equations themselves. And it's the first quantity up there that basically sets it. In any relativistic scheme, the continuity equation requires a different density variable than what one would typically call the density as the conserved quantity. And that basically sets up the rest of the scheme. You typically have a momentum evolution equation with three components. You've got an energy equation. And in an MHD simulation, you've got your magnetic fields. There's an important note. In the whole talk today, I'm going to assume a stress-energy tensor for a perfect fluid, where the portion in blue there is the MHD-specific part. Essentially, MHD makes your stress-energy tensor more complicated. If you want to add microphysical effects that change the stress-energy tensor itself, then obviously it'll have a larger effect on the resulting evolution equations that I can't really generalize because it depends on what you're adding to the form. It turns out that the inversion process of going from the conserved variables D, S, tau, and B in one particular notation scheme back to the primitive quantities, density, internal energy, velocity, it's not really a hard problem to specify. Essentially, if you can identify what the Lorentz factor of any given grid cell or SPH particle is, you've essentially gotten all the steps you need to disentangle the whole system. It's just that finding it is numerically involved sometimes. Not fundamentally difficult, just it's a numerical technique that has to be done. The big problem is easy to specify. You typically end up dealing with the enthalpy. The enthalpy appears in the first term of the stress-energy tensor. For a polytrope, the enthalpy is immediately relatable to the pressure or the internal energy. For a non-polytrope, it's not. It's still related, but it's no longer an easy analytic formula you just plug into in most cases. And that's basically the complication. From a numerical standpoint, again, conservative for primitive variable conversion. It's basically the non-explicit step of the whole evolution scheme. It's the one thing where you can't just write out the explicit formula for how you're going to evaluate the next equation. It's a set of implicit equations that need to be solved. So basically, whatever method you use had better be efficient. You're going to be doing it at every grid cell or every SPH particle. You need to choose something that isn't going to slog the whole code. The other thing, though, the solution method has to be extremely robust. You don't want it to fail because then you have no idea what your hydrodynamic state is in your hydrodynamic simulation. And any error you make is going to propagate throughout the rest of the volume thereafter. Making life a little more challenging, sometimes because of numerical errors, you actually get completely unphysical conservative configurations. This is bad. So you need some way to deal with it. In practice, if you get something completely unphysical, you need to make sure that however you fake it, because again, you'd have no, you either have to go back in time and re-evolve yourself or basically adjust the data by hand. You need to make sure the primitives remain smooth. Any non-smoothness you introduce into the primitive variables like density or pressure or things like that will immediately cause shocks and all sorts of other badness that's not real in your system. It's not that it's complicated, it's just that you're not allowed any leeway in doing it wrong, basically. In GR Hydro, it's actually a fairly easily specified problem. This entire slide in no way makes any mention of the assumption behind the equation of state, microphysical or not. The basic idea, and I don't want to get too drawn into the equations, they're basically there as a reference for later, for after everyone has their coffee digested, and so do I. The basic idea is that the first equation is the conserved density squared multiplied by the definition of the Lorentz factor. The second equation is the definition of tau, which is basically your conserved energy variable. It's two equations in essentially two unknowns, but it can be treated by simple one-dimensional Newton-Raphson. You assume a value for the pressure. You can solve for the Lorentz factor. You can immediately transform the Lorentz factor to get the internal energy density. You now have enough to basically reevaluate the pressure and iterate. The derivatives work. It's happy. It works. The conditions for GR Hydro are easy to state for what you need for a physical solution. Tau, the internal energy density, has to be positive. And the magnitude of the momentum has to be sufficiently small. This is either requiring the enthalpy to be greater than or equal to 1, or alternatively that the velocity be subluminal. It's basically the same condition. But it's a straightforward system. Numerically speaking, this is the kind of thing you can give an undergraduate in a computing class. And they might get right. With magnetic fields, life gets more complicated. You still have essentially two defining equations. They have more terms. The idea in the equations, anything in red is a conservative quantity that we know. Anything in black are the primitive quantities that we're solving for. You'll notice that there's basically three variables that appear, the velocity squared, this quantity W, which involves the enthalpy and the Lorentz factor, and the pressure is determined by the other criteria. Writing out the same analytic criteria, this is what makes a physical solution, is substantially more difficult, if at all possible even. But, I mean, it's a few equations and a few unknowns. So Scott Noble et al. In 2006 basically laid out a number of possible ways to solve the system and did a comparison. They found essentially the two most efficient ways to solve it are either solve equation 2 by Newton-Raphson and just plug into equation 1. You notice equation 1 is a little complicated. Potentially difficult terms to have in numerical derivatives. It turns out the more robust method is to basically do 2D Newton-Raphson. 2D Newton-Raphson is still fast. And it turns out the method was more stable. Stable basically means one failure every few million times rather than one failure every few times 10,000 times. These methods usually work. It's just failures are really, really not allowed. So at least the method that at the moment is going to be implemented in the Einstein toolkit for polytropes is to use the 2D Newton-Raphson technique. Again, it's nothing earth-shattering. There are alternate ways to write the equations if you want to solve for slightly different variables. In the ultra-relativistic case, for instance, you have to be careful with what velocity variable you use. You need something that's not going to be singular. So the whole talk comes down to basically solving one little problem that appeared here. So in Mignon and McKinney, they wrote down the scheme for a general equation of state. The only problem is that they assume that you can solve for the pressure as a function of the density and enthalpy. But for many tabulated equation of state, this is not the way you write it down. That's the whole problem in the talk. What we want is just a scheme that instead of doing pressure as a function of density and enthalpy, which basically ends up kind of implicit in requiring a whole nother go-around, we want something in terms of pressure, in terms of density and internal energy density, which is generally the way that the pressure is evaluated explicitly. It's certainly in Einstein toolkit and in most other codes. That's the problem. I can tell you already, we're going to be doing Newton-Raphson. We're going to involve derivatives of the pressure. And as Matt Dewey pointed out in his talk very clearly, unless those derivatives are nice, smooth functions, then you have a classic textbook example of where Newton-Raphson can run into trouble. So the smoother those derivatives, the more robust the resulting methods will be. But that's just a general point. If any time you need to invert a nonlinear set of equations, the derivatives being smooth obviously make the numerical techniques work better. So here's the big takeaway. I realize it's a thrill. Essentially, these are the same equations rewritten in terms of, in this case, three variables. The velocity, this enthalpy containing variable W, which again is the density times the enthalpy times the Lorentz factor squared. It's just a convenient choice, typically. And the third one is U, the internal energy density with the density included. So U is rho epsilon. And basically, there's two obvious solution techniques you can use. One is to solve the first two equations by Newton-Raphson with W and U, and use that last equation to basically solve for V squared. The other option is to take the first three equations on the page and do a three-dimensional Newton-Raphson. 3D Newton-Raphson is the point where you start to slow down numerically and use a lot of flops because the matrix inversion takes a little work. The 2D version is likely to be slightly less robust in some cases, but numerically faster. And the basic takeaway, since 3D Newton-Raphson is the place where numerical methods start to crank more than you want, and again, you have to be efficient. There's no excuse for this to be the big time sink in your code. It's a straightforward process. Basically, the ideal solution is basically start with 2D Newton-Raphson. If that works, you're done. If it doesn't work, try the 3D, which is a bit more robust. If that works, you're done. If it doesn't work, drop to something, then you slog. You do 1D with bracketing if possible, and you crank out your point because you can't fail voluntarily. This should work for any well-defined equation of state model, though obviously you need uniqueness of pressure as a function of enthalpy, or otherwise it's not clear which route you should actually take. And smooth derivatives help. It's a Newton-Raphson technique. Additional parameters can easily be included in this formalism, so long as you know them going into the Newton-Raphson step, as long as you know additional parameters like the temperature when you're going into the conservative to primitive conversion, add whatever you want. And last, I think this is more of a philosophical point than anything else. The Einstein toolkit is public. So the one good thing is that all the techniques here will basically show up in the code base there very shortly and can just serve as a reference in case people need. That's the benefit of a public code. And this talk here, too, has the equations in case anyone ever needs them. And that's it.
So I had a naive question. We can tabulate the equation of state ahead of time any way you'd like. We can tabulate it in terms of enthalpy instead of temperature and so on. So is there a more useful way to tabulate it?
It turns out that, the method for doing everything if you do have it tabulated in terms of enthalpy, It appears in Mignon and McKinney already. This is just a variant on that. This is nothing, there's nothing here that's all that particularly different. If you have it already tabulated any way you want, you can basically use an inversion scheme that's already tailored to however you've tabulated your equation of state. The choice of kind of P of rho, comma, rho and epsilon is slightly more common. Some equations of states just happen to work better in that formulation. So this is basically, if you have it in that form, you may as well use a Kondoprim technique that is adapted to it. But honestly, whatever way you have it, the last thing you should be doing is rewriting the equation of state piece just to do this.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to me a very simple step you do once and then run simulations lots of times.
Right.
If the reason for doing it that way is that you use the equation of state in addition to compute the characteristic structure in a different point, and there it's based on whatever variables you're doing the reconstruction on. So it's usual, but not essential, to do the reconstruction based on density and specific internal energy. It would seem dangerous to me to use two different tables in different parts of the code that have been tabulated in different ways, even if they were in principle equivalent, because I think that would be a real, really large source of numerical error. So the question then becomes, is it more important to reconstruct one set of variables, or is it more important to do the conversion between conserved and primitive in terms of one set of variables? And my experience in terms of flow near black holes, very high velocity flow, is that it's actually the reconstruction that's more important, and that the conserved to primitive just needs to be robust, which, as Josh has shown, is a rather difficult thing to do, but it's far easier to make mistakes in the reconstruction.
I mean, you can just make the recovery of the temperature directly. I mean, you just have to say, I mean, my primitives is density, temperature, you recover temperature, and at the end, once you know the temperature, you automatically know the internal energy. So you don't really have to, I mean, you can recover the temperature, and then since you know the internal energy, reconstruct the internal energy, and that is... I mean, that is. I mean, we are doing that, and this is faster because you don't have to search for the internal energy in each iteration.
Yeah, I guess I shouldn't have said temperature. So basically, you can include in your anything else that affects the pressure, any other third variable that affects the temperature, as long as you know what going into the scheme, basically, should not cause any problems. I guess that's all I wanted to.
Regarding the equation of state, I think that for a relativistic code, having the equation of state tabulated in terms of epsilon and internal energy rather than temperature would be easier to use, because epsilon is one of the variables that comes into the form of the relativistic fluid equations, where temperature is not explicitly there. And for reconstruction, for primitive solving and so on, it would be easier, I think, to have that variable rather than temperature as the independent variable in the table.
Right. I mean, the one benefit of the kind of the modification I just showed up here is that you if you assume that this is the format you want, then the sound speeds are easily calculated while you're doing things, and the sound speeds are useful for the Riemann step. But there's many different. This is hardly a unique choice. It's likely to be convenient. I wouldn't try to oversell it more than that.
Any other questions?
If I could just get you to elaborate, when you say smooth is important, is smooth just monotonic? Is it 10% changes? What means smooth in the derivatives?
Sure. So. Which question do I show? Yeah, so equation one here, it looks a little gnarly. It turns out it's well-behaved. It's, for instance, the velocity as a function of this quantity W is monotonically decreasing. And the variability with respect to all of the known conservative parameters is monotonic in increasing, increasing, and decreasing, for instance, with regard to the three parameters. For all these equations are potentially nonlinear and take a little bit of numerical work, they're well-behaved in the sense that they either go up or down, and any technique where you have bracketing your head will work. The only thing you need to watch out for, it's not even a, this isn't even a so much a physics problem, it's just a standard math problem. You need to watch out for all the standard places where Newton-Raphson methods fail, where basically, you know, you don't want it cycling, or the standard failure conditions for any Newton-Raphson as a math technique. As long as those can be avoided, it's fine. Honestly, the way to work in practice, if you happen to get a singular set of values where the Newton-Raphson fails, in the end, you can always drop down to a 1D bracketed technique. You want to avoid it. It'll be slow. But the smoother the functions, the less they have vertical slopes, the less they do all sorts of weird things, the more likely it is to work. But it's the standard Newton-Raphson kind of conditions. It can be broken, but it's pretty robust.